I'm alive.
Would you call me Dr. Juan? Come on, Brennan.
All right. Nice to serve too, is it?
Yeah, you know. Nice to see you. It's been a while. It's been a while.
It's been a long time. We've been playing this since, what, October?
Oh, yeah, I had a lot of stuff going on.
How's everything going?
What's up, boys?
Hello, hello.
Wait, I can barely hear you.
I love Amir's acoustics headphones there.
Oh, wait. I think it might be playing through the speaker.
How are we doing?
Fix my audio.
Where'd you get those headphones, Amir?
Those are big.
Those are
wait, geometric. If you're talking shit, give me 1 second so I can hear you. Why is it not letting me switch it to my headphones? What the hell?
Why they come out so far from your head?
Echo cancellation.
You gotta be careful when you turn your head. You might hit the camera.
It's like that claw when you're trying to get the stuffy in that little machine.
Right. Brendan, you prefer no headphones?
Hey, yeah. Hey, Joe, are you using your cell phone?
Wait, I am. Are we doing no
Can you
headphones?
Turn it on landscape mode?
How do I do that?
Just flip it on its side.
Oh, okay. Let me see.
Because then you're going to get cut off every time. Okay. Like half your face is going to be in the thing.
Let me see here.
Take my headphones off. Can you guys hear me fine?
Yeah, you're good. You're good.
You'll have to turn the lock off on your home screen.
Yeah.
You probably have it auto your rotate lock on.
I do. Let me see here. Good to have you experts on here.
Yeah, otherwise when it gets chopped up, you're going to be like half a face. I don't know what happened.
Right, right.
There we go. I'm going to have to do it like this. Oh, wait, hold on.
You got to turn the lock off.
Hold on.
Dude, Amir, where'd your headphones
go? I thought we're doing no headphones.
No, I didn't say that. I was just talking about
you guys
about
hear me?
Him.
We're just making fun of your headphones. Yeah, yeah, we hear you. But now you're...
You got to turn your auto-rotate. If you go to your home screen,
yeah.
You should see a lock, the thing that says it's locked. Press
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, no, I unlocked it. Now it's locked. Hold on. Is that better?
No.
Wait, why didn't it change?
I'm low tech. No, it was unlocked, sir. Now it's the lock is off now.
There's a little function there that you can rotate. Let me see what mine does. Hold on. This is a great podcast. Thank you all for tuning in.
Amir's gone.
You want me to turn it back up the like this?
So Joe, on your home screen, that little rotate thing, you press that thing?
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
When you do that, it should allow you to.
Yeah, it's doing it. Hold on. Wait, let me see.
My IT boys are a little rusty. New to the instruments.
Man. Yeah, the portrait orientation lock is off, sir.
Okay.
It's off.
I wonder if.
Joe, maybe just flip your phone.
Maybe re-log back in to the link.
Put yeah, I'm trying.
Just try that last time.
Okay, hold on. How do I log off, guys? This is bad.
Welcome to the Back Teeth Boys.
No, no kidding.
We actually know what we're doing when we're in the office, guys.
Oh, my goodness. Watching.
We know how to take teeth out and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, this is comp.
Was it Joe last time that had a salad bowl on the desk?
Yeah, he was resting his phone on like a couple books with a salad bowl.
This is a really
I like Amir's microphone though. It looks like a bazooka tube coming in. Boom, boom.
It's my microphone stand. I don't have anywhere else I could put it.
Yeah, I guess not. As long as you sound good.
Sound good, look good.
Amir always looks good.
Hey guys,
the girls on here don't feel that.
You got a Daytona on? What was that? I saw that for a quick second. What was that? Holy smokes, gold?
This one's yellow gold, yeah. It's not brass. Recording, is it?
Of course man. It is.
Yeah, we're recording right now.
We're recording for 5 minutes, dude.
Amazing, good.
I heard you in your bathroom. That's why I hit record.
I was in the bathroom.
Were we with?
You know, just a pre-flight leak, you know?
Yeah. Get the jitters out. Get the good old.
Oh my God, Joe! So good, so good.
Look at you.
That was worth the wait.
Good quality video and everything.
Oh, it's even better. Yeah, you're a
thirst
trap.
Who's the oldest guy in the group?
You're a thirst trap right now, Joe.
Doubt it. Highly doubt it. You got me confused with the mirror.
I'm old. Yeah. What was that?
Did we get some new books back there, sir? What do we got over there?
I got some. Yeah, I got a background going on. Yeah. It's probably
What's
hard to see.
Glass incubator thing. What is that up there?
The one up top? That one? That's whatever. I can't even read. Ooh, this is not easy. I don't know whether people do this. It's like a steampunky like light bulb thing. I can turn it on. I had it turned on for when I did the podcast this week with Jason Auerbach, and I had it turned on, and then I did another one after that with Brady Smith, and I had it turned off. I think I like it off better. It's just too bright.
Okay.
So It's just for looks.
I've been trying to take one picture, and every time I've got someone in the worst possible way.
Dude, do it again. Do it right now.
Everyone ready?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There we go. Perfect.
All right. Nice. What are we going to talk about? I know Amir had like a list of questions last time. We never even got to a bunch of these clinical things.
I don't know. I don't even know where that list is, to be honest.
Dude. The list. But I got like one comment on my thing. Like, talk about sinus stuff. I'm like, I think we already talked about some of that stuff last time, but
did we hit sinus?
I think we hit it with Joe before Brendan was on.
Yeah.
Ah.
No, we talked about taking out two teeth in a row, how you can have a more likelihood to have a communication. Sir, you said that if you were taking out like the third tooth in a quadrant and you were already in the sinus, you would stop and then have them come back. Remember that?
Did you read the minutes from the last meeting? Or like,
No.
How do you remember all this stuff? Yeah, you're right. I did say that.
Right.
Yeah, we talked about that. I write down
everything you say. You're like the authority. No.
So what Joe's saying is we kind of talked about, let's say you're taking teeth out on the upper left, like the two molars, 14 and 15, upper left, first and second molars. And like you take out 15 first. I always start with a distal tooth. I don't know. I assume you guys do too, right? You're taking out 14 and 15 upper molars, upper left.
Yeah.
You start with the distal one first, right? That's pretty standard. Yes. So I take out that distal second molar. Okay. And then there's let's just say a 5 or 6 millimeter sinus opening. Do you still take out the first molar because that's on the treatment plan, or do you stop there, try to repair that, and then come back another day for 14? I think that was a good question that we had last time that we kind of talked about a little bit. I don't know. What do you guys do? I know what I do. If it's a big opening, like 5, 6, or even bigger than that, I would try to close that and then wait another day for the other one rather than opening potentially a much bigger opening with that adjacent tooth.
Yeah,
it depends on the case, but that usually can happen, you know. Unless you have a lot of bone in between them and you're not worried about it and the x-ray looks okay, you know, looks like it's a separate thing. But I don't want to deal with like a 15 millimeter or 10 millimeter opening versus a 5 or 6 either, like, and then ruin your whole schedule for the day. But, you know, I don't know, and for the patient, obviously, it's not a fun thing to get, you know, a buccal flap and a fat pad graft and all that stuff right away. But yeah, I don't know. What do you guys do?
Yeah, it's inconvenient, but I think the patient overall understands and say, hey, you were treatment plan to have these teeth taken out. I'm going to stop here. We're going to come back in a month or so when that closes and heals, and we're going to take out the adjacent tooth just because we're already in the sinus. So, I mean, that's a pretty easy conversation to have. It's inconvenient, but I think it's well received.
Makes more sense. I haven't had that yet. You know, I never really thought about you take out one tooth, say it was what you were saying it was 15, and now you have to 14, but you're looking at 15 as like a 5, 6 millimeter. I haven't had that yet. Yeah.
Oh, it's going to happen. Don't worry. You'll have it happen.
I had a guy come in with.
You're going to see it all. Honestly, you're going to see. If you take out enough teeth, I always tell people, if you do enough extractions and whatever, you're going to end up seeing pretty much every complication almost. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And some of it aren't your own, obviously. You get referred these things in, right? It's just like, you're going to see a lot of stuff.
I could have referred a guy with osteonecrosis of the jaw, back left maxillary area. It was a hole just on the buccal mucosa superior to 15, like a good chunk, like a centimeter by half a centimeter. And there, it was just for extraction of 15. And I look in there and I'm like, wait a minute, this is bone. This isn't like food that the guy had for lunch. So then I took out 15 because it needed to go. And then I just decided to let's cut this whole thing open. I reflect a flap. The whole thing's dead. The whole left maxilla is dead. So now I'm in a thing because, well, I can't code this or bill it for anything because Medicaid prior requires like prior approval. I didn't know any of this. So I just start drilling it all out. Right. And now there's a small, tiny opening into the sinus, but some fresh blood. Like I took probably a good centimeter chunk out of left maxilla, square centimeter. And then I'm just following now for it to close up. Everything's healed over, but there's like a hole in it. It's completely mucosalized, but there's a hole in where the area is. I don't know, but it was weird because he was like referred around between a GP to a perio. Perio saw him a couple times, but didn't do anything. It was a very, very weird situation. And of course ends up in my lap, but
you're going to see a lot of this.
Yeah.
tricky case. I mean, something like that too. I'm sure you're going to see them in follow-ups, but I always look for like actinomycosis infection, fungal infection. So if it's not healing well and it's just healing slow, or the whole thing opens up again, I usually would do a biopsy there too. I would say, hey, let's just get this. Because when you do a biopsy, you're going to send it in formalin, right? Mm-hmm. And then that's most of our biopsies, that the normal ones are sent in formalin, right? Unless you're doing like a, you know, a Michelle's solution for vesicular bolus or something. But you send it in formalin. And what the pathologist, my pathologist at least, I use Dr. Oda, and she's been doing it forever. And a lot of times they'll comment if they see sulfur granules in your biopsy, which is consistent with possible actinomycosis infection. If they're not seeing the bacteria in the path specimen, right? But they can see sulfur granules. Mm-hmm. So that leads me to think that's an actino infection. And actino normally is hard to culture. Like if you have someone, you know, with an actinomycosis infection, it's really hard to culture that, to be honest with you. So if you even culture it, you're probably not going to grow anything. So I usually cheat and do it through the biopsy. And a lot of times based on the sulfur granule and the way it looks clinically, if it's actinomycosis, they're going to need long-term antibiotics. And if it's not healing with oral penicillin, I usually send them to an ID doctor and get a PICC line. And then they do that. And then I follow them up clinically to see how they're healing, if they need more debridements and things like that. And then I can put them on PO once it's healed enough, or you know, have ID put it, you know, they're managing them at that point. And they'll transition them to PO penicillin for another few weeks to months even. And then it could be like 4, 5, 6 months sometimes to clear that up. I mean, that's, wow. I've seen those over time, 1 or 2 a year, I'll see those.
Wow. I think I did biopsy it. Yeah, I got to look into that.
Like, yeah, ask your pathologist if they could look for sulfur granules too. Some of them don't look for those things, but you can probably ask them that. It's like a little back way in to get an actino kind of diagnosis. I don't know, Joe, you seen some
of
those?
That's wild how you can see two of those a year. I don't think I've seen one in 15 years.
Really?
100%.
I was going through a spurt for a while where I was just treating these actinomycosis infections. Like, you know, they call it, like back in the day, they call it lumpy jaw, right? Because they're so slowly forming, like you get these fistulas that form so slowly, they don't cause the patient any pain. And then they grow for so long that you can get like little fistulas in the skin. And that's why they call it lumpy jaw, because you'll get like these little puffs on your face with pus draining out. Oh, that doesn't hurt, but because it happens so slowly. That's the scary thing about actino. Actino is a bacteria, first of all, and it's commensal, right? So it's not something that you get. You already have it. It's just whatever reason it decides to overgrow in that spot and then infect the bone. And, you know, that's the problem. So, yeah, I always
think of actinomycosis. Has that been part of your board prep, Brendan?
It has. You know, well, I mean, we all know that, but like the one where it's the extra oral fistula, that's many times the actinomyces, right? So for listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sulfur granule, that's a buzzword as well.
Bingo. That was actually my oral surgery Viva exam question.
See, this stuff happens. This stuff
Third
happens.
Year
I've seen
school.
It multiple times. We're doing a board prep for Brendan tonight, apparently. So, you know. Do you have your boards?
That means
you have your boards
to
pretty soon, right? No, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
I thought we just did. Oh, okay, yeah.
How's if, that going, if you by run... the way, Brendan?
Oh, yeah.
It's going. I was just telling someone earlier today where it's like, you know, you study months for this thing, the oral, the verbal one, right? And then you start to realize like, what, I knew this 3 months ago in October, November, I knew the TNM staging. And now I'm like, wait a minute, is it 2 centimeters or 3 millimeters? Or, you know, get to that point where things start to get fuzzy.
And you're
like, what? A month ago I had this.
What you should do is get on a FaceTime or something with, you know, the maxillofacial surgeon in Australia. Oh, you've seen his cases on Instagram, right? There's like clean neck dissections and it's like so clean looking. Like if you've seen any of his stuff and just get, you know, he'll talk to you in his Australian accent and you'll remember it.
That's a good idea.
I've chatted with him before. I'm like, he's, you know, trying to get him on the podcast and stuff too, but he's like, I'm like, I just listen to this, like Crocodile Dundee's son or something. That's like great. You know, it's like
ruined.
But
Amir, that's you did dental school in Australia, Amir, didn't you?
Yep.
That accent. Yeah.
There's no accent to talk about.
That's Canadian, dude.
That's not Canadian. Don't even.
You sound Canadian.
No, I am Canadian.
Yeah, I know. You sound
but Canadian. For a while, like maybe for a
try to hide the accent.
For like a bit of time, maybe there was a little bit of an Aussie accent coming along, but like it's gone. I lost it in the airport.
in the airport.
When I was boarding that flight, they're like, accents are left behind. Done.
Right. Oh, man.
What cities were you in Australia?
I mainly lived in Sydney, but then when I had like reading breaks and stuff, I've traveled around.
What's your favorite city? Sydney?
Sydney for sure, by far.
How's the nightlife there?
You know, it was so wild that they put these lockout laws where they ended all the nightlife at like 2 a.m. And I think, gosh, I can't remember correctly, so don't quote me on it. But I think like after midnight, you weren't allowed to have hard liquor anymore. Because apparently, a couple of years before I went, a tourist died because of a drunken brawl that happened outside on a street. So over that, they like changed all the rules and all that, but still.
I feel like that happens every day in every city in America, almost.
Yeah, no kidding. Well,
something like that. But I guess it's Australia, but wasn't that a prison colony? Aren't they used to that stuff? I don't know.
Sensitive.
Australia, I've never been. That's why I was asking. How's the nightlife?
It's worth the trip, for sure.
All right. It's a long trip.
But well worth it.
I think they're like 19 hours ahead from where I am. That's crazy.
From where you are, it's a very good plane ride.
Yeah. It's like a 19-hour time difference ahead, something like
that. I do have a good topic. I have a question for you guys. Say you're doing very, very high impacted maxillary third molars, completely covered by bone. You got to get way up there, so high up where, you know, if you try and do the incision, maybe you pop one papilla, but it's still not high enough to kind of access it. Don't ask me why you're doing this. Don't ask me why.
Why'd you say papilla?
I was thinking of Pamela and then the papilla at the same time.
Oh, you say papilla in New York? I didn't know papilla. That. That's what? Cool. That's so cool.
We say papilla.
Oh, papilla. Papilla. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like composite.
There's no editing of that. You got to keep that in there. All right.
I don't edit.
Yeah.
I want to go over like incision designs, right? Because you have the crestal and tesocular and you inch it up, right? Recently, I was trying out the... Like I go about halfway up that second molar, and then I just make a vertical right up, and then I repair that with a stitch at the end to make sure that it's nice around the gingival margin. I'm concerned for gingival recession later on, but when I've been watching them postoperatively a week out, it's pretty good. But I wanted to see what your guys' insight was, what incision designs you've tried, what you use now.
Exactly what you described. But if it's a high, that vertical leg, I'll just creep it up. You know, just kind of know in advance you're probably going to get into the buccal fat pad, but that's just part of the territory, to be honest with you. But sometimes you have to do it. And if it starts to get tight mesially, I'll take another papilla. But I'll never do bilateral vertical releasing incisions on upper wisdom teeth, but I'll just extend that envelope as far as possible. But mainly the vertical leg, I'll just creep it up as far as need be.
Wait, so where's your... Your vertical leg is just straight distally?
Just, distal the second molar.
Yes.
Yeah,
so just... you never do a second one on the buccal side of the second molar. I mean, just one straight.
Rarely. I mean, if there's tension, I'll extend it mesially a little bit, but mainly it's just a distal of the second molar.
And then you just do the envelope. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I've had some
high hairs from there. Yeah, you don't want to tear that for sure.
No. That's why I was just I've tried several now where I just do like the equidistant between the mesial and the distal of the second molar. So on the buccal, I've made a vertical release right up there, and then I repair that with suture at the end.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. So you do a vertical releasing on the buccal.
I've been doing that for really high ones. Yes. Perfect. But any contraindications from your guys' standpoints?
Like vertical releases for getting out an upper third, you mean, if you need to extend your flap? Yeah, so most of the time, like 95, 98% of the time, I'm just doing it with the envelope flap, right? Like you've seen some of my access. It's like distal buccal release. I go around the facial of that second molar. Like I stop at mid-facial. I don't ever extend it to the papilla. What I do is then I basically put the Minnesota in and lift it up. And if I need to get higher, like you're saying on a case, like if I'm doing that and I realize that tooth is even more superior than what my exposure is. And I try to get the envelope flap more released without a releasing incision first. I'll get under it more and then try to work my periosteal or my Woodson or something under there. And then see if I can still, if I feel like it's too much tension and it's going to tear, then I'll make a vertical release. And the way I do it is I don't go through the papilla. I go right before the papilla. I leave the papilla attached to the second molar and I just go right before it and make my vertical like that trapezoid, like Joe was saying, you know, the wider base kind of thing. And that usually gets me where I need to be, but I don't lift the papilla. There was a whole thing about this on Instagram this last week about papillas and incision designs and things for lower molars. But yeah, for upper molars, even I try not to, if I don't have to take the papilla, because I feel like that gives me more recession.
Huh.
That's harder to manage sometimes. I don't know. It just looks like, sometimes it looks like butt for a while, and I don't like that. So I don't know. Not nice butt, bad butt.
Looks like bad butt. Amir, what about you?
For me, it depends on the patient's age. If it's like a really young patient, like a 16, 17-year-old, to be honest, I don't worry too much about recession. I've only had to do a vertical release on an upper 8 maybe 3 times in my entire career so far, because I do exactly what Joe said. I'll just extend my papilla. Like I'll take one more papilla. And I think once I even came, like I had a case where I was regretting why I even like did that case in the first place, but the tooth was so superior. And this patient's flap just had no mobility to it whatsoever. You felt like it was so keratinized. It wouldn't move. So I actually had to do a vertical release on that. But sometimes if it's an adult patient and I am worried about recession, especially if it's someone in their like late 30s and stuff, or if they have any kind of bone loss around that region, because once that bone is gone, you're going to get some recession under it for sure. And those I'll just extend it as anterior as I need. So I've even come to the mesial papilla on the fourth. And I don't know what number is in the American.
Premolar.
I've come to the second or first.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's pretty far forward. Okay. Okay. No, this is good insight, guys. This is good insight. Yeah.
That's my school of thought as well. Coming from somebody who's torn mucosa before, sometimes you want to be conservative and you have good intentions, but you can sometimes do damage. So I think a longer incision, it's not ideal, but it's better than the alternative.
Yeah. Yeah. And then would you repair yours with, say you take one or two papilla?
Yeah, I will.
I feel like I'm using a bidet right now. No. So would you repair it with sutures after that, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. You, the papilla, you repair with sutures?
I'll repair the papilla if I extend it anteriorly. So on a typical non-superior upper wisdom tooth, a more routine type, I usually don't suture the uppers really ever.
Right. Yeah. Same.
It's pretty rare. But when I'm suturing the upper, it was up there.
That's a good topic to chat about. I got another one submission. D's nuts. That's what it was.
It's always D's nuts. Huh. I mean, when is it not?
Did anyone else get the BTG questions?
I did not.
You did not? No, Joe did.
I did.
You got a BTG question.
Yeah. I told him it's going to be a 3-part series coming soon.
All right, Brendan, take it away. What questions do you have?
Other than that was it. It's what I got. That's what I got. I got another. I do have another one, though. Okay. I've been using in practice now, I've been using a contraangle, right? All through residency, we didn't have any contraangles, only straight handpieces, right? It was like the Stryker burr, I think. I really like the way the BN Air looks and uses, but we don't have that. We only have contraangles. And I'm finding, in residency, I would just hemisect. You know, I would cut the mesioangular wisdom teeth. I would just cut in between the crown and then getting down in between the roots, like interradicularly through the roots. Crack that in half, and the crown would come out with the distal portion, including the root, and then, you know, most times, and then the mesial portion would also stay connected with root and take it out like that. With the contra angle, you can't get that split if it's a very horizontal mesial angular, right? So what I've been doing now is just cutting the crown off and then taking the roots. My question for you guys is, because in residency with the straight handpiece, I would, for disto angulars, those, just cut the crown and then wiggle the roots out distally and take them out. With the contra angle, now that's the problem. So I figured it out with the mesioangulars. Do you guys use contra angles? I think we did talk about that once, but how do you do the distoangulars now? Since now I got to like reverse everything because I'm going from straight to contra angle.
By contra angle, you're talking about the high speed that Joe and I use?
Like where it's like the straight handpiece is when it's got the burr on it, but the contra angle is, how do I describe this, guys?
Is it electric, Brendan, or is it air driven?
Air. It's air.
Okay.
Okay. So it's like the impact.
45 degree
contra angle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly like you said. I would use the, on a distal angular impacted wisdom tooth, first of all, I'd make sure the tooth was mobile, but then just section the crown. You know, section the crown, take the crown off, and maybe make a purchase point, and then get like a Cogswell and just roll it out. But you have to make sure that the whole tooth is mobile before you section it. That's kind of my rule.
Yeah, elevate it a bunch, get it wiggling. You know you're not going to elevate it out usually if it's distoangular. As long as you get some movement on that root, I feel more comfortable about just popping that crown off and trying the purchase point. If that doesn't work, then trying to go down and section low. But yeah, try the purchase point first is what I usually do.
Whole tooth?
In the horizontal crown section for sure. On distoangulars.
Yeah, yeah. But it, like, bones in the back, you just removed it.
Yes.
I keep getting these distal angulars and the roots are like this. They're cupping the bone underneath. They don't want to go anywhere. I'm not getting any mobility, guys. Right?
Yeah, I know.
Three of them again today.
So
you got city teeth. You got city teeth, man.
That,
you don't get those suburb teeth.
That case that you just described is like 45% of my cases per week. But I do them on patients between 35 to 45. So it gets even better. And I either get the roots that do this or roots that do this crisscross on the bone. But I get what Brendan's saying, because with that handpiece, sometimes it could be a little bit tough. What I've, out of trial and error, I've tried so many different techniques. The best thing to do with a case like that is first, with your contra angle, section the distal part of only the crown. Because with that handpiece, especially if their mouth opening is like not super big, you're not going to get the angle right to section it right down the middle into the root. So I section that distal part that's hitting the ramus that won't let you elevate. Mm-hmm. Then I'll come on the mesial, attempt to elevate to get a little bit of mobility, like Joe said. Because if it's not mobile, then if you section it, you're kind of toast. Once I get a little bit of elevation, you'll see it come up. And then now you've got the anatomy of the roots that's preventing it from coming out. Then you can actually see the furcation. And that handpiece, because the burrs on those handpieces aren't very long. So you've got to get it up a little bit to see the furcation and then section it.
The instrument, write down this word, this term is called the EL3S or the EL3C. It's got a really thin head on it. And when you say you're not getting any mobility, that's so important. If you can just get that down there, because a lot of times it's wedged between the second molar and the third molar, right? The roots are almost fused. But if you can get in between there and get a little mobility with that instrument, because a lot of my conventional instruments won't fit down in there. So you got to get the really durable, thin tipped EL3S. The 77R sometimes won't work, and just get a little mobility and then do what Amir said.
Joe,
how thin is that head, Joe? How thin is that head again?
Real little. Thin.
He's trying to say it's the motion in the ocean. That's what he's saying over there.
I hear it.
Joe, that elevator you're talking about, is it those very thin luxators that have the fat handles to them?
Yes.
That there's like three or four different sizes?
I've got two. One straight and one is curved.
Can you post a picture of it later?
Of course. Of course. I have a lot of people who they watch my videos and they know when I use something different. And I forget who I got the idea from. I forget who it was, but he said you have to get this instrument, and I did, and it's impressive. I mean, I like it. I almost like it equal to the 7R. I just haven't replaced, haven't put them on all my trays yet. So I asked for it specifically.
You're not talking about the spade, are you? Is that, what's the
second? No, it looks like a regular 301, just a straight elevator, except that, like I said, the tip is really, it's thin. I mean, you can get it in some tight spots. And I've broken them before, but you're not going to break this one. It's pretty durable.
Doesn't have a little bit of a back bend on it kind of thing? Or no?
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
You know how it's cupped? Usually it's maybe a little
like
less
concave
of a cup.
Portion? Or the whole elevator is straight.
Let me see if I could pull it up.
It's a little more straight, to be honest with you. Yeah, it's the EL3. But when you don't have any mobility, you have to do that before you section.
Were you saying were you asking about the back action? Where those back actions.
Joe, is it these ones? I don't know if you can see them.
That's ratchet. I can't see that.
Very similar. My handle looks different than that, but the tips look pretty similar.
Similar? Okay.
Yeah.
Because that case that he just described is like 45% of my load every week.
I think whatever we struck a nerve with a mirror over here, and those disto angulars on 35-year-olds.
Those disto angulars, they take forever. Those are the ones that are getting caught up with.
Especially if they have a little bit of ankylosis, you're in for a ride.
Oh, yeah.
So what happens is, so this is a kind of a similar thing, but I've even today I saw a consult for it was like a 42-year-old gentleman, and he had a lower impacted 17 lower left wisdom tooth, and those roots just were all embedded around the nerve. Like the nerve and those roots were in the same plane of space. That whole half of the tooth within the nerve on the Panorex film, we're sharing the same plane of space, right? It was like mid root level on a 42-year-old. And really thick roots just, you know, wrapping around everything. And the problem is, no one wanted to take that tooth out over time, but that tooth is just popping through the gums just a tiny bit, right? So in my opinion, it's like, you got to do something. I mean, at that point, it's just, I know you're 42, you've been living with this thing, but that thing's become a food trap, you know? And maybe for like the whole time, it was like covered up. And then, you know, for whatever reason, it just, you know, pops through a little bit. And that's the problem, you know? So that's why these patients that don't get these teeth addressed for long periods of time, and now they're in their 30s and 40s, and it's a much bigger deal taking something like that out with a little bit of more risk to their nerve and all that stuff. Just a food for thought, you know. And when you're treatment planning some of these cases, like, nobody wants to take them out. They're like, I'll just kick it down the road. They'll see some other oral surgeon, you know, I'm sure. And then
I had a guy like that today. He was 64 years old. He had just recently gotten a partial denture, but they left in number 17 and 32. And 17 started to come to life a little bit. And so he already had pain, you know, radiating to his ear. And he already had paresthesia. You know, the dentist didn't want to do it. So they sent the patient to me. And, you know, contrary, I think those are easier cases to do, like less stress, because the patient's already numb. The patient knows.
I like the way you think, Joe. I like the way you think.
I love that. Like, it's what
I mean. Zero stress.
What can I do worse?
Joe's a man of the people.
Zero stress, and I say, like, it says it right here. It can happen permanently, and hopefully it'll come back. But you need to have it out. But there's no debating; it has to come out. So it's going to be hard technically, but as far as like the sequela
risk assessment.
You're like, oh, you got paresthesia? Let's do this today. Let's do it right now.
I didn't do it.
Just go to town.
Right. You don't even need injections.
You don't even need to sign a consent form at that point.
Right. And I tell patients, you know, the worst thing I can do is leave that thing in there. And then they're like, yeah, you're right about that. You know, so, and what's crazy is he didn't get it done. He said, I'm going to think about it. I said, all right, you know, whatever. But yeah.
Speaking of that, and then we touched on this before. I know Amir and I have spoken about it before, but some people still believe, I think, that cornectomies are terrible.
Oh, I've got
I think everyone gets their own, you know, opinions on things. I totally agree with that. I just know in JOMS, like our journal and other journals of oral surgery, there's definitely studies on cornectomy. And even this past year, there's like two or three that came out, all saying that it's, you know, essentially good. They've compared split mouth studies between cornectomy and extraction with nerve, you know, it's like they've done a lot of work on this topic. And, you know, I think cornectomies are a valid treatment option in a lot of cases, not a lot of cases, but, you know, when they're indicated, they're indicated. So I just wanted to touch on the cornectomy again, just because we're talking about these crazy wisdom teeth and 30, 40 year olds. And sometimes I go in there with the thought of, I talk to the patient first. I'm like, you know, we're going to go in there and remove this tooth. And you do have a higher risk. It's still small, but a little bit higher risk for some post-op paresthesia. And I always tell them, you know, even if you do get it, it's usually temporary, but it could take weeks to months to come back. And to be honest with you, if it still, you know, doesn't feel the same on one side versus the other after a year, that could be permanent. So there is a risk of that. And I tell them, if we go in there and the roots are completely fused to the bone and they don't move, we may consider just doing a cornectomy at that point. And so we go in there with the plan of extraction and or cornectomy. I don't think that's a bad way to treatment plan some of these cases. They know that, you know, they could wake up or whatever and it could have a cornectomy or an extraction, and I've prepared them for it, you know, rather than trying to get in there and deciding to leave stuff in. We don't talk about it ahead of time, things like that. So I don't know how you guys approach some of those cases.
I mean, not talking about the technical aspect of it. If you look at one of Jason's former posts, BTG, I think he had advice for younger doctors. He may have been talking to you, Brendan, I'm not sure. But I think one of his messages was communicate, over-communicate, communicate some more. And that's kind of what I do, just to set the expectation so that when patients, if they have that complication, I think they knew going in that that was a possibility, you know, and I think they just appreciate the conversation. So you really have to, you know, make sure the patient is aware of that before you touch them.
Amir, before we get into your story, I just wanted to comment on that. Sir, what you were saying before, you know, that wisdom tooth that's just barely peeking through the gums that keeps getting, but the roots are like wrapped around the nerve and stuff. And it keeps getting kicked down the road. Something I want listeners to know is that that is absolutely a food trap. And it may seem asymptomatic now. It may never become a problem, or so you think, or so the next practitioner thinks, or so the patient thinks. The fact of the matter, that is a problem. And that is a food trap. And that food trap leads to cavities, pericoronitis, or large gross caries of the crown. Once it becomes gross caries of the crown, that can no longer be a candidate for a coronectomy. So kicking it down the road does a lot more harm to the patient than good. Because now if you have to go and get out this grossly decayed tooth, you're trying to dance around the nerve like that, you end up nicking it or something, that's more likely going to happen versus just send it to someone, stop kicking it down the road, or do it yourself, coronectomy this thing before it becomes gross caries. It's just going to live down there forever. The roots are going to be fine. They're going to have no nerve damage. If it is, it's maybe a month tops from my experiences from coronectomies. They'll get really swollen from the coronectomy, but everything will be all in well afterwards, and you're not risking nerve damage or caries. That's just my experience. I really think it's better to address the problem before it becomes a big one.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's definitely a food trap, and it needs to be addressed somehow, rather than just keep kicking it down until the next surgeon has to do it because it's infected at this point. You know, and it's harder. They're not opening wide enough. It's just a lot of stuff going on. And you're right. I've seen those decayed crowns, and they're really fused roots. And then you're like trying to, and it just keeps chipping off, and you know, and now you're just left with this mess. It's really difficult to deal with because patients in pain, you know, teeth are harder to numb when they're so inflamed. There's a lot of stuff going on there sometimes. But yeah, so I think coronectomy is a good option in cases. And that's why I still do it and offer it, you know? So I don't agree with people just all of a sudden, just, you know, honestly, I just don't understand that. Just no, never do it. The biggest risk of coronectomy by far, and it's still small, is root migration. And really what that is you leave the bottom half of the roots there. Let's just say 5 years down the line, those roots migrate more superiorly. Maybe now they're peeking through. And then you're like, oh, I got to go in and get them out now. But then you don't have any risk to the nerve then either. So yeah, it's a second procedure, but now you have zero risk to your nerve because they've migrated up anyways. So yeah, it's two things, but what you're really trying to avoid is a long-term deficit that stays with that patient forever, which is the worst case scenario, right? Especially if it's a dysesthesia, not just a paresthesia. So root migration, yeah, I can live with that. I mean, it's a second procedure possibly, but in a much easier way to get it. You can just pop those out a lot of times. It's not so bad, you know, in my opinion. Yeah, small risk of infection, a little bit more post-op pain. It's hard to say, but again, it's my opinion. It makes sense.
And Joe, you're right. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. I have that exact conversation when I do have, when I do the coronectomies about the potential of a second procedure, but that the nerve migrates away from the tooth and the nerve, they separate, and it's a simpler procedure, less risk of nerve damage. So it's a long consultation with coronectomies, but I think you need to have it just so there's no surprises.
I agree. Communication set the expectations. Amir, let's hear the story of this bozo who doesn't believe in coronectomies.
Well, let me actually start with another story. Last year, I actually had a patient that was referred from the public hospital because this patient had... She was 75 or 76. It was like a mesioangular impacted wisdom tooth. Patient had cancer, was going through chemotherapy. Wisdom tooth got infected, gave her a really bad case of facial cellulitis. And then they said, you got to go see an oral surgeon or a dentist to get the tooth taken out. So then the oncologist and I had to sit there, coordinate timetables of her chemo schedule so that she can stop chemo for about 10 days or so, so she gets enough blood cells back up so that we can take this tooth out, have enough recovery. So I always tell patients, I say, look, you're young and healthy now, and your body can most likely withstand this procedure easily, and you're going to heal fine. You don't know what the future is going to bring for you. And this wisdom tooth might be asymptomatic for the next 40 years, but what if it flares up on you in your late 60s, early 70s? I mean, now you got a bigger risk to worry about jaw fractures at that age. So I always tell that story to people, and they're like, no, now that you say it, like, I understand where you're coming from. Cause like especially with, I find it's maybe more in the Asian population or the Middle Eastern population. There's like no sense of wisdom teeth need to be removed. It's like not even really talked about by their dentist. So I find a lot of patients, like they say, oh, I've been going to the same dentist for like 15 years or 20 years. And no one's ever mentioned that I need these wisdom teeth out. They've told me leave it. But coming to coronectomies. So I had a patient that once upon a time, and this is a true story, patient needed a wisdom tooth out. And on the pan, you had the beautiful classic signs of root darkening, deviation of the canal, and all that stuff. So I said, okay, there's probably a little bit higher risk of nerve injury in this case. And it's a prophylactic removal. She was asymptomatic with it at that time. So I always discuss the options and I say, look, we can refer it for a cone beam CT scan to see where the nerve is exactly going in the path. And we can have a second consult, you know, doing a little bit of a risk assessment. CBCT came back as severe nerve compression and the nerve was going in between both the mesial and the distal root. So it was kind of just doing a little loop in between them. So I talked to the patient and I said, look, I think it's probably a case where it's better done under deep sedation for you. Okay. And I prepped her. I said, there is a good chance it's better to do a coronectomy on this case because it's an elective procedure. And the way I word it with my patients is when you say coronectomy, everyone just looks at you like, can you repeat that and spell that out? What did you just say? So I say it's a two-stage extraction. That's how I word it for them. I say it's a two-stage extraction. We'll remove half of the tooth now, which is the symptomatic or the problematic part. And down the future, if there's problem with the roots, then we'll remove the roots after. And the way that works is they'll allow the roots to start migrating away from the nerve a little bit to reduce risks of any kind of nerve damage. That people can click onto right away. So I prepped this patient and she said, I want to do it under deep sedation. And at that office, I couldn't offer deep sedation. So I had an OMFS guy that came in to do the case. And in the consult, this gentleman completely threw me under the bus. Like to the point where the patient then had a third consult with me being like, did you lie to me? What is going on? Like the surgeon said, I don't do coronectomies. Coronectomies are malpractice. They're not indemnified. If you have a complication with a coronectomy, you can get your license suspended because you're doing it like intentional malpractice. It's not scientifically board certified. Oral and maxillofacial surgeon here in Canada. So I'm like, you know, when patients tell me stuff, I don't 100% believe it. I'm like, there's always miscommunication. They think they heard something and whatever. Yeah. So anyways, they ended up doing a full extraction for the patient and not a coronectomy. This was always in the back of my mind. I'm like, well, do I not refer coronectomies anymore? Do I not offer it to patients? Has the literature changed? So I remember I messaged Serv and Joe and I said, guys, like, did something change since last week till now? Because I'm sure Serv had a podcast not too long ago with Dr. Jackie and they were talking about coronectomies. And I called my other oral surgeon friends here in Toronto. I said, are you guys like not doing coronectomies anymore? They're like, yeah, we are. I'm like, this was what was said. And they're like, that's impossible. There's no way. So I gave the person the benefit of the doubt. Fast forward a couple of months later, there was a dinner and a lecture, and one of the speakers was this surgeon. And the surgeon gave a lecture on wisdom teeth, and there was two very interesting points that were brought out in this presentation that I wasn't sure if the wine was too strong or I'm mishearing stuff, but I questioned everything about my career so far. One was about CBCTs, and I quote, the use of CBCTs for the removal of wisdom teeth is absolutely unnecessary and not required. And the justification was that CBCTs are only taken by GPs just to know when they're supposed to refer a case. That's all. As a surgeon, we never need a CBCT. Have I been taking all these CBCTs because I'm just scared and I want to refer the case? Like, or was there an actual intention behind it? Because last time I checked, many surgeons that I work with, many of the oral surgeons that are friends of mine, they'll CBCT one out of four cases or one out of five cases. Like, nobody wants to get sued or have liability on them. So That was number one. And then the second thing was coronectomies completely disproven, 90% failure rate. You can get infection, root migration, blah, blah, blah. And it is not backed by science. It is not backed by your college. It is not backed by your insurance. And if a patient makes a complaint, you've got no leg to stand on because it's not an indemnified procedure.
Wow.
I just had a few more glasses of wine and I just kept my mouth shut.
Usually and more wine is an old guy, right?
No, young gentleman, great surgeon. Great surgeon. Like a very, very good, capable surgeon. But I'm not really sure where the disconnect in the information is because like the statements are not backed by science. So
there is good literature in our journal and other journals about coronectomy. And it's valid. There's a procedural code for it. It's covered by insurance here. But if all that's true, I mean, they're not going to cover something that's not proven to, you know, to be a, you know, treatment option. So that's part of it. So I don't understand that part. I think sometimes what can happen, I know, Brendan, you're closer to residency than me and even Joe, but sometimes where you train, like if you have a core group of doctors or one or two that are more influential and they go through this dental alveolar stuff with you. And sometimes you kind of adapt their philosophies too. As a resident, you know, that can happen. I can see that happening too. Maybe the person that he trained with was severely against it or something, or maybe they had some complications in residency from coronectomies and he's just latching on to that going forward. That can happen too. Like some people have, you know, complications in residency. They're like, I don't like that procedure and they don't do it when they get out. Right. I mean, that can happen. It's all like human nature. So I don't know. I'm just speculating, but as far as the data, there's definitely data on it. I mean, you guys can talk about that too. There's CBCTs though. The way he said it may not be the best way to phrase it for me, but I don't usually get CAT scans on any wisdom teeth. I just assume the nerve's always close. And for me, that helps. You know, I only get them if sometimes they're referred to me, they already have a CAT scan from the GP or something. I rarely get them unless there's pathology or if it's, I feel like it's an abnormally deep tooth. But for most, even most, you know, what we code as difficult bony impactions, I don't usually get them, but I don't know. Everyone's different.
So I have a question for you on that. If you have a patient with a high riding IAN that's almost in the middle or coronal one third of the wisdom tooth, and it is in your path of troughing or sectioning or decoronation, how do you go about knowing if the nerve is running on the buccal or on the lingual?
So I know there have been studies on nerve position and post-op paresthesia. Even in our journal, like a year or two ago, there was a study that said that so the nerve can be buccal to the tooth, lingual to the tooth, or just under the roots, right? Most of the time I think it's buccal so I just assume it's right there no matter what. And so when I'm sectioning, I'm rarely going through the whole tooth. And I know that I just don't, because I know I don't want to pop through. And especially even on the 2D film, if I feel like it looks like that case I told you about today, the guy came in, the 40 something year old, that lower left wisdom tooth with the big roots with just peeking out the gums. I mean, I'm doing that case without a CT scan. It's just, I'm assuming the nerve is right there. You know, just, I know in residency, we do, you know, even out, obviously, orthognathic surgery, right? You're always around that nerve. I mean, so like you're moving it, you're skeletonizing it, moving it around. And so, I mean, that's not a big deal in a lot of cases, to be honest. I mean, we do enough of those procedures where touching the nerve, you know, that's usually still not a big deal. What we're talking about is cutting through it, which you don't want to do. So when I make my cuts, I'm pretty cognizant of staying in the tooth, you know, and I have an idea if I go through what the safe zones are, you know, for me. I don't know. Everyone's different, but so I feel like I get good visualization for it.
What'd you do today with that tooth then? You said it was like around the nerve, right?
It was a consult today. So we scheduled the procedure, but we'll just get him in and take it out. I talked to him about coronectomy and or extraction.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I usually use a little PRF fibrin plug on top. So, you know, extraction with the fibrin PRF or coronectomy with a PRF on top, just the fibrin part, just the red tube or whatever colors you're using. I don't know, but yeah, that's how I'd manage those usually. I know, Joe.
Joe, what's your thoughts?
I agree with what you said. I rarely take them. I'm old school like you, Serv. So unless it's pathology or it's really close and I can almost guarantee that there's going to be some paresthesia after, it's just an extra piece of communication I can use to talk with the patient as far as afterwards, kind of preparing them. But it's pretty much the exception that I take them for wisdom teeth.
And the one thing I want to add too, I think it's reasonable, and we have to think medical legally in these cases, right? So I think it's reasonable for an oral surgeon to make that call. And then I think it's also reasonable for, a dentist or a periodontist or somebody who's taking out the same tooth to feel like they need the CT just to honestly protect themselves for medical legal issues. And that totally makes sense. I mean, it's the world we live in. So I think that's part of it. And it's going to be always a part of it. And so I think from that aspect, I mean, I totally understand all that, so that's just kind of another thing.
Amir, you were talking about this. You were saying, what's the first question they ask when, if a case goes to litigation, the first thing they ask is,
did you have a CT? Well, here in Ontario, we have probably one of the toughest and most strict dental colleges or boards in entire North America. It's not even like this in the rest of Canada. But it's insane. They're trying to take away the rights of GPs placing most implants now. So they've actually given out a document with the new implant guidelines that any implant that requires any kind of augmentation, or it's in like D4 bone or like anything, if there, it involves a sinus lift, this, that, blah, 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 that GPs have to refer to a specialist.
I'm not opposed.
They should bring up some legislation.
Send that.
And I'm sure so an oral surgeon probably lobbied the college, okay?
Where's the donate button?
Yeah, but that's hard. I feel like the cat's out of the bag there. Like, I don't know how you could reel that in. I don't know. Especially if you're saying dentists can take teeth out. They can do periodontal surgery. They can do endo. They can do what they're comfortable doing, right? I feel like that's how it is here. So I don't know. I can just limit one thing and say, oh, you can still do gum grafts and then you can still do, this and that. So I don't know. Botox. I don't know.
Probably wisdom teeth's next. Don't even start, Brendan.
I'm going to start lobbying now. Are you kidding me?
I'm going to come and work in your county just so I can take them away.
What were we saying? We were talking about with the CBCTs. I get a CBCT. I mean, the patients want to know. I want to know. I'm in New York, where in Long Island too, where everyone's trying to sue everyone. I mean, yeah, I don't want to take that. New York's probably top five, if not three states for like patients trying to litigate. And I'm not trying to cause any harm, but then God forbid if there was any, it's like, I want to know where that nerve.
No, you do these close case podcasts and things. Isn't nerve issue still like the highest, one of the highest close case or litigation things for dentists and surgeons?
This will be number one.
Right? Nerve issue. Yeah. The hard thing with nerve issues is a lot of times it's perceived as subjective. Like it's hard to test for unless the patient's saying they feel this. And honestly, how do you
tell them otherwise?
Without an EMG, like even with an EMG on a sensory, like how do you really even know? I mean, it's really difficult, clinically.
And one of the drivers in these cases is somehow, some way they find another dentist that places a lot of implants or specialist, and then they start to team up with the patient to litigate against the other dentist. And
These people are paid though. They're paid specialists. Like that's their part. Like part of their practice is they get hired to be a whatever.
Wow, that's crazy.
Like, that's part of people do that. And they work both sides, right? So yeah.
So I mean, are a lot of those closed case settlements, are they because of poor documentation? I mean, when I listen to those OMSNIC podcasts and I hear that, a lot of it is the record keepings. But just say, for example, you have somebody who comes in, you take out their third molars and they've got paresthesia, and then, the consent form is signed, it's watertight. You do your mapping after the fact. You have your theory behind your mapping, and then you make the appropriate referrals if necessary. How can you be proven at fault? I mean, just because of that sequela, I guess is my question. Because you've had those lawyers on your podcast before, haven't you?
Yeah, I had Dr. Mark Leffler. He's with MedPro, and And yeah, it, a lot of it, but there's just you, and you got to see some of the stories and cases though. The documentation just is like Swiss cheese. It's full of holes. You know, it's not so, there's always something in these cases. It seems like where it's like, they should have noted that somewhere along the lines, you know, it's like they've had three phone calls and they didn't write one note down about it, or, you know, somewhere along those lines where it's like, well, wait, you were saying that the patient did feel sensation on their post-op visit 1 week out. And then all of a sudden it wasn't. So they definitely were not feeling anything. Why did you know? So it's like there's always something.
When I have those post-op visits for paresthesia, I am typing pages, you know, hey, so can you feel temperature? Yeah, you know, I drank some coffee this morning and I felt a little temperature there. And then they'll come back because I have them come 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and 4 weeks. And then I'll start at the third week reading the notes back to them from the second week. All right, so last week you said you drank a Coke and you felt the temperature on your lip. You said it was better than the first week, and then blah, and I just read it down the list. So it kind of reminds them what I'm saying, or what they said, and then I'll just continue on. So if there's progress, you know, I'll do my little mapping and my pictures and I'll, you know, show them that sort of thing. But I don't know. I just think that if you have really good documentation and you have an adverse sequela, that proving malpractice, I think, is difficult if your documentation is good. I could be wrong and naive. I don't know. It's never happened to me.
Knock on wood, right?
Knock
on
wood.
Yeah. Yeah. It depends on the documentation, the communication with the patient, and also depends on the state they're in. That's what Dr. Leffert was saying. I mean, this is more in subjective areas, but he was saying that certain states, the jury and so on, whether the judge, sometimes they side more with patients versus providers.
Wow, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, we're at about 10:04 now, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Want to keep going? I mean, where are we at? Because I want to get us back to doing these more often. Oh, hey, Serv, how's Brady doing?
Oh, he's doing good. He's been out of the hospital. It's my son. He's been out of the hospital over a month now. Hanging in there, doing good. Yeah, he was in there for like 33 days. I don't even know. Oh my but gosh. Yeah, long time.
That's a long time.
Yeah, it's a long
great
time.
Great to hear, man. I'm happy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's good. It's good. Yeah, I'm back on track, just catching up with everything. So, got a new backdrop. Amazon.
Sounds good. Everything. Is that a salt lamp, too? I see two salt lamps.
Yeah, they got some salt lamps back there. I don't know. I couldn't figure out.
Pouring the salt? What's going on?
No, I'm just trying to get my feel like Amir, you know.
Zen.
Amir feel has like Amir zero zen. Amir has been working Sydney, 14 days.
On a nice Sydney night, you know.
14 days? Is that a Chick-fil-A cup over there? What is that?
Yes, sir.
Nice.
Eat more chicken. Yep.
He's living the batch life.
Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much. I've been drinking this since lunchtime.
Oh, that's a long. That's, you got to finish.
What's
that
in it?
Amir, you said 14 days?
Just water. Ice. The ice is melting and I'm just drinking it. But it's iced tea.
What do you get at Chick-fil-A?
I had breakfast this morning because I was, for whatever reason, I skipped the gym, so I was hungry, and I was debating. So I got the, I guess it's like the Egg McMuffin, except they have it at Chick-fil-A. So it wasn't even chicken. And then the, you know, the little potato bites and the unsweet tea. Yeah.
That's from this sexy morning? That's from this morning, that drink?
Yeah.
And there's still ice in it?
Yeah. Scary, I know.
I want to know how they preserve that ice for
hold on, muffin. Hold on. Is there a time on here? There's no time, but yeah.
That's crazy. Ice.
That's crazy.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
What kind of ice lasts 12 hours?
It's not even a Stanley.
I went to leave at 5 o'clock today, and I went to throw it away, and I shook it, and I said, oh my gosh, there's ice in here. That's like, you know, bonus, and I just
kept it. You gotta keep that one.
Sir, you're gonna send that cup to the pathology lab so they find out what's growing on that ice. Right.
It's Mactino in there, probably.
Like, what is preserving
it? On.
You got a little aspergillosis in there.
Yeah. Swear to God, like 12 hours.
You're going to get the lumpy jaw.
It's all right. There's antibiotics for that.
How little was that? That thin was that head again, Joe?
It was little. I'll post a picture later.
Actually, I want to see what the elevator looks like. Sure.
Big? About that. Maybe double that.
Double that. Okay.
The camera adds a couple millimeters, so maybe it's like.
right.
All right, guys, I'm going to go get ready for tomorrow. This is a good one. Get the back teeth boys back together.
All right.
For sure.
Good night, gents.
Enjoyed it, guys.
Take care.
Later.
Yeah.
Talk to you soon.
Take care. See you
guys. In February. Bye.